as the teacher of the street among the villagers. Water scarcity is a significant and accelerating problem for people worldwide. A UK-based charity, WaterAid, has installed life-size ice sculptures in London to show the fragility of water and the threat posed by climate change.
Climate change is water change, so it means that droughts will get longer, which means that previous reliable sources of water just won't be there. It means that flooding, sometimes in the same country, becomes very severe, polluting water sources and destroying infrastructure. But it also means unpredictability. Water sources that people have relied on for generations, farming as well as for their health and hygiene, are just no longer there.
Farr, a policy analyst for WaterAid, said people with no access to clean water are bearing the brunt of climate change. The sculptures opposite Tower Bridge are part of the charity's fight, which calls on the British government to increase funding for climate adaptation. The sculptures show how clean water is essential for human survival, with some being depicted carrying buckets and pots in search of water. The environmental group wanted to highlight the threat climate change poses to our planet.
Egyptian archaeologists have completed the renovation of a tomb of an ancient king, providing a rare glimpse into the world's oldest known pyramid. The 4,700-year-old Step Pyramid was built during the reign of King Djoser. The southern tomb is the second for the king, and it is smaller compared to royal tombs. Some researchers suggest it was built for the preservation of Djoser's internal organs, while others say it was built symbolically. It had been undergoing renovation for 15 years before being reopened to the public.
120 tons of blocks were raised by Egyptian hands, astonishingly, and with the determination to achieve one goal. That is the reconstruction of the tomb, just as it was 4,700 years ago.
The complex is historically significant, as it is the earliest known example of the Egyptian custom of pharaohs being buried in pyramid-shaped tombs. According to experts, ancient Egyptians believed that this step design served as a gigantic stairway of the soul of the deceased pharaoh that could ascend to the heavens. Now, we've all grown up playing with a pinball machine at least once in our lifetime. Now, a free runner has designed a giant scaled-up pinball machine, turning it into his personal playground. Latvian free runner Paša Petkuns came up with the idea of playing on real-life pinball machines during a road trip. The set, made in London, is not for the faint-hearted, as it is slanted at a 45-degree angle. Paša thought his breakdancing experience might help, but in the end, he had to invent a whole new style of movement. The producer of the film, showing the performance on the machine, described the set as very scary.
It's 17 meters high, it's 16 meters wide, and 20 meters long. It's an angle of 45 degrees, and I don't know if you understand how much 45 degrees is. It's like, it's a double black diamond slope. It's something you don't go down, you can't, because it's more like falling than anything else.
It does sound scary. Now, the impressive set, designed to look like a retro pinball machine you might find in arcades, took 7 weeks to construct. Global landmarks like the Eiffel Tower and the Statue of Liberty are featured in it. Petkuns works as a Hollywood stunt double. Plastic pollution has become one of the most pressing environmental issues, as disposable products overwhelm the world's ability to deal with them. But a young Spanish designer is dedicating his time to the cause of recycling plastic waste. 28-year-old Humberto Les quit his job last year to focus full-time on his environmental efforts. He collects trash from the coast of his home island of Gran Canaria. Humberto usually picks up an average of 5 kilos from the shore at a time, After he is done compiling, he processes the material and turns it into pieces of furniture. Umberto's aim is to make the task of recycling plastic economically justifiable, that is.
I decided to leave my job, stability, to come back here to develop a project to clean the coastline by designing furniture, because I realized that the coast could not be cleaned in an altruistic manner. So I found a way to give economic value to the waste found in the coast.
Umberto is making products ranging from clothes hangers to stools, but he also wants to create larger products with a longer lifespan in the future. According to the UN Environment Programme, only 9% of all plastic waste produced throughout history has ever been reprocessed. Around 80% of it remains accumulated in dumps, landfills, or nature.
A floating concert venue has entertained music lovers in London. Renowned pianist Masayuki Tayama and his partner started a project to play on a canal boat traversing the city's waterways 2 months ago. Since then, they have performed 9 concerts, and their upcoming performances are already sold out in months ahead. The couple came up with the idea after living on a narrow boat with a digital piano.
This is the piano boat, which is the only canal boat of its kind. It was built to our specifications as a floating concert venue. So we have a brand new Steinway grand piano, and here we give musical experiences for people on the canals.
The artists believe the experience is very different from playing in regular concert halls. They say recitals on the boat create a unique interaction with the audience and it feels friendlier.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Small fairy pigeon Vader has interrupted a cricket match in Ireland. A playful puppy ran into the field of a semi-final match and caught the ball. The scene caused laughter amongst those present. After a few minutes of chasing the dog, players managed to get the ball back. The funny video has gone viral on the internet.
Cayman and a local tour guide in Bolivia's Amazon region have formed an unlikely friendship with bond going viral on the internet. Although people are warned to stay away from caimans, Alejandro Gil has struck up a friendship with one special reptile named Jesus. Despite the caiman's carnivorous nature, it shakes his tail and allows Gil to pat it on the head after being fed. At 4 meters long, Gil, however, admits that getting close to Jesus does still make him nervous.
My knees shake when I work with Jesus. I'm always scared and very careful, and also respectful to tourists. Guides in the Pampa de Yacuma and across Bolivia consult with tourists before undertaking an activity. If they agree with it, then we do it. If one person is not in agreement with an activity, then we don't do it.
Gil says they are only able to get in touch with a caiman in a dry season when the river is at low water levels. They lose the reptile in January when the river rises. Caimans inhabit Mexico, Central and Northern South America, from marshes and swamps to mangrove rivers and lakes. Their diet consists of a great deal of fish, but caimans also hunt insects, birds, and small mammals and reptiles. A new initiative initiative has been launched to turn the spotlight on the misery of Syrian refugee children. Little Amal, a giant puppet depicting a young Syrian refugee child, has arrived in St. Peter's Square in Vatican City. This 3.5 meter tall puppet has traveled all the way from Syria to Turkey, Greece, and Italy. It will then go to France, Switzerland, Germany, Belgium, and the UK to focus attention on the urgent needs of young refugees. Syrian refugees, especially children, are in a dire situation after being driven from their homes due to the conflict in their country. Archaeologists have discovered the largest ever bronze mask in an archaeological site in China's southwest Sichuan province.
This is a large bronze mask we unearthed from the central park of the number 3 ritual pit. The widest part, from one tip of ear to the other, is 136 centimeters, and the height is around 75 centimeters. It can be regarded as the largest bronze mask unearthed in Sanjingdui, and even the largest in the Shang and the Shu dynasties.
The mask was found together with other cultural objects, such as ivory and bronzeware. These items needed to be removed first before handling the mask, which made the extraction process complicated. Restoration work is underway on the largest bronze mask taken from the site. The relic is believed to be thousands of years old, dating back to the Shu period. The site is an archaeological treasure mine belonging to the Bronze Age of over 4,000 years ago. The area was first discovered in China in the late 1920s. An Australian zoo has welcomed two baby bilbies, an endangered species. Their birth has brought joy and hope to zookeepers and wildlife enthusiasts. The baby bilbies were born in Taronga Zoo in Western Sydney. Zookeepers named the two male joeys, Molly and Cliff, after a national park that once was home to herds of this animal. The birth of the joeys has raised hope among the zookeepers of reintroducing the species to the wild. Bilbies were once found across 70% of Australia's landmass. They are believed to have inhabited Australia for up to 15 million years.
Chameleons changing color is one of the most fascinating traits amongst living creatures. Now, can't humans make a robot with the same capability? In a science lab in Seoul, a team of engineers have created a robot that mimics the color-changing ability of the famous lizard. The researchers have made the skin with a special ink that changes color based on temperature and is controlled by tiny flexible heaters. The head engineer says creating a wearable device that can actively change color and patterns was the main goal of the study.
The pattern of South Korea's military uniform is made for woodland and certain colors. So if you wear this military uniform and go to the desert, you can be easily exposed. Actively changing colors and patterns to match different surroundings is the key of camouflage technology, and we made this possible.
The total thickness of the flexible, multi-layered artificial skin is thinner than a human hair. The scientists envision that their research can be adapted for military uniforms to help soldiers blend into their surroundings. It can also be used for aesthetic purposes such as fashion, exterior of cars and buildings, as well as future display technology.
Visitors and staff of a French zoo have been amazed by the surprise birth of two African lion cubs. The babies, a boy and a girl, were born 2 weeks ago in Amnival Zoo. Their birth was unexpected due to their father's advanced age of 17. The cubs will live under constant surveillance for a couple of months so that their health is reassured. According to zookeepers, they are currently in good health. The Amnival Zoo has asked people on social media to name the newborns. The German capital Berlin turns colorful as the annual mural festival has brought artists together to display their works around the city. Artists have instilled new life into neighborhoods with giant murals that attracted hundreds of visitors. This year's event was resumed under the motto Home Street Home after its 2020 edition was canceled due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Organizers say the paintings invite people to discover the city as a gigantic open-air gallery.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A U.S. drone strike in Afghanistan last month killed 10 civilians, including 7 Afghan children, and not an ISIS extremist, as first claimed, the Pentagon has now admitted. In a briefing on Friday, 17th of September, the top commander of the U.S. Central Command, General Kenneth McKenzie, said he now believes it was unlikely that those who died were ISIS militants or posed a direct threat to U.S. forces at Kabul's airport. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian columnist David Smith. The piece is titled U.S. Admits Kabul Strike Killed 10 Civilians and Not ISIS Militants. A U.S. drone strike in Afghanistan last month killed 10 civilians, including 7 Afghan children, and not an ISIS extremist, as first claimed, the Pentagon has now admitted. In a briefing on Friday, 17th of September, the top commander of U.S. Central Command, General Kenneth McKenzie, said he now believes it was unlikely that those who died were actually ISIS militants or posed a direct threat to U.S. forces at Kabul airport. I am now convinced that as many as 10 civilians, including up to 7 children, were tragically killed in that strike, General Kenneth McKenzie, wearing military uniform, told reporters. Moreover, we now assess that it is unlikely that the vehicle and those who died were associated with ISIS or were a direct threat to U.S. forces. I offer my profound condolences to the family and friends of those who were killed. This strike was taken in the earnest belief that it would prevent an imminent threat to our forces and the evacuees at Kabul airport. But it was a mistake, and I offer my sincere apologies. General Kenneth McKenzie said it was not a rush strike, and efforts had been made to minimize civilian casualties, but he acknowledged that a terrible mistake had indeed been made. Asked if anyone would be held responsible, he said, "We're in the process right now of continuing that line of investigation." For days after the 29th of August airstrike by a single Hellfire missile, Pentagon officials asserted that it had been conducted correctly, even though numerous civilians had been killed, including children. General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had held it as a, quote, righteous strike, unquote. But news organizations later raised doubts about the version of events, reporting that the driver of the targeted vehicle was a longtime employee at an American humanitarian organization, and citing an absence of evidence to support the Pentagon's assertion that the vehicle contained explosives. General Kenneth McKenzie ordered an investigation by Central Command. It found that the strike killed Zamari Ahmadi, a worker for Nutrition and Education International, a non-governmental organization that distributes food to Afghan civilians, along with 9 members of his family. His car was reportedly carrying water bottles rather than explosives, as claimed by the Pentagon. The New York Times said, Ahmadi's only connection to the terrorist group appeared to be a fleeting and innocuous interaction with people in what the military believed was an ISIS safe house in Kabul, an initial link that led military analysts to make one mistake after another while tracking Mr. Ahmadi's movements in a sedan for the next 8 hours. The U.S. military was on edge at the time of the incident, fearing a repeat of the attack by a suicide bomber that killed dozens of people, including 13 U.S. service members, outside Hamid Karzai International Airport, ahead of U.S. military forces' controversial withdrawal. Lloyd Austin, the U.S. Defense Secretary, was briefed on the findings of the investigation on Friday morning, 17th of September, and directed a further review. Lloyd Austin said in a statement, I offer my deepest condolences to surviving family members of those who were killed, including Mr. Ahmadi, and to the staff of Nutrition and Education International, Mr. Ahmadi's employer. He admitted, we now know that there was no connection between Mr. Ahmadi and ISIS terrorists, and that his activities on that day were completely harmless and not at all related to the imminent threat we believed we faced, and that Mr. Ahmadi was just an innocent victim, as were the others who were tragically killed. We apologize and we will endeavor to learn from this horrible mistake. Human rights organizations welcomed the investigation as a move towards accountability, but demanded further action. Brian Kastner, a senior crisis advisor with Amnesty International's Crisis Response Program, said, the United States must now commit to a full, transparent, and impartial investigation into this incident. Anyone suspected of criminal responsibility should be prosecuted in a fair trial. Survivors and family members of the victims should be kept informed of the progress of the investigation and be given full reparation. It should be noted that the U.S. military was only forced to admit to its failure in the strike because of the current global scrutiny on Afghanistan. Many similar airstrikes in places like Syria, Iraq, and Somalia have happened out of the spotlight, and the U.S. continues to deny responsibility while devastated families suffer in silence.
Over the past few years, the United Arab Emirates has tried to project itself as a land of wealth and luxury. The Persian Gulf state has been alluring many from across the world to pursue their dreams in this part of the world. As part of its branding strategy, Abu Dhabi is now giving golden visas to international celebrities, a 10-year renewable residency. Yet the other side of the story is not that golden. Lebanese singer Najwa Karam, legendary footballer Cristiano Ronaldo, Egyptian actor Nelly Karim, and Tajik influencer Abdul Razak all have one thing in common. Apart from their fame and wealth, they're all in possession of the UAE Golden Visa, a win-win for everyone. For the UAE, the presence of these celebrities helps the Emiratis raise their country's profile as a desirable destination.
I also know that they've granted, UAE passports to over 200 Israelis, which is concerning because that would allow the Israelis to travel through anywhere in the Middle East, any Arab country, and that seems to be also a dangerous exercise to allow Israelis to get access to UAE passports when the Palestinian issue and other problems like Israeli violations of Lebanese airspace, attacks on Syria are still there. And I think this should not be allowed. The Arab world should work together to try to address those concerns and not simply try to ingratiate themselves to the Israelis.
Last year, when Egyptian singer and actor Mohammed Ramadan was granted the visa, he posted on Instagram, "Thank you to the ruler of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid, may God preserve him, for the most beautiful gift of the golden visa. May God bless the rulers and the population." Indian actor Shah Rukh Khan, Canada-born fashion Instagrammer Ola Farahad, and Lebanese pop singer Maryam Fares are also among the dozens of international celebrities who received the visa and posted special thanks online. Abu Dhabi introduced the Golden Visa in 2019 as part of its strategy to develop its entertainment industry and attract foreign investment while refreshing its appearance with the presence of A-list celebrities in the UAE.
Well, I think it's a public relations exercise and to present a good image for United Arab Emirates because they do have a lot of problems. There's lots of dissidents that are in prison. And it's perhaps also a way to attract entertainers and other people to the United Arab Emirates and try to expand the entertainment sector.
Meanwhile, handing these celebrities the golden visa on a silver platter has triggered a backlash in a country where its women are still unable to pass down citizenship to their children. In the words of Sophia Kaufenbrenner of International Campaign for Freedom in the UAE, the UAE is free to attract foreign investment by extending Emirati citizenship laws, but it should end the gross discrimination regarding women and stateless groups. Whereas the slightest criticism might be punished with a prison sentence in the UAE, outstanding figures have begun criticizing citizenship laws. For example, Sheikha Jawahir Al-Ghassimi, the wife of the ruler of Sharjah, tweeted earlier this year, "Naturalization for the children of female citizens, a demand. Jobs for the children of the Emiratis, a demand." Alluding to the existing discrimination against Emirati mothers with foreign husbands. Emirati citizenship laws also discriminate against a Bedouin or stateless population who are entirely excluded from obtaining Emirati nationality, no matter how long they have lived in the UAE. Many Bedouin have spent all their lives on Emirati soil, and often have been there since before the creation of the UAE in 1971. According to Laura Van Wass, the coordinator of the Institute on Statelessness and Inclusion, ISI, such discrimination runs counter to international human rights law and has a knock-on effect on the child's enjoyment of other basic rights, as well as on the family as a whole.
It's definitely discriminatory and very heavy-handed and authoritarian, where people who express, their opinions or have, some sort of political dissent, the UAE is revoking their citizenship and therefore leaving them stateless. And also this is a policy of intimidation to sort of attack the relatives of such people in order to silence dissent. In the short term, this does not really prevent the problems, it only hides them. But in the long term, it's actually going to create dissent and create more anger and resentment for the regime because they're punishing people by revoking their citizenship. This is a very serious measure and is condemned around the world because you shouldn't revoke citizenship from people simply for exercising their political rights or for speaking out.
Critics say the UAE Golden Visa is part of the country's PR campaign to portray itself as a modern, open, and tolerant state. In reality, the UAE is one of the most repressive states in the MENA region, with an estimated 200 political prisoners behind bars in the country. Many prisoners' families have been stripped of their citizenship to intimidate them into silence. That can be disastrous for prisoners' relatives. All of a sudden, getting a job, earning a pension, education, and even accessing health care becomes near impossible. The late Ala al-Sadiq, daughter of political prisoner Muhammad al-Sadiq, is a case in point. Ala gained asylum in the UK in 2018 after being driven out of the UAE following a campaign against dissidents between 2011 and 2012. The UAE government stripped Ala and her 9 siblings of their citizenship in March 2016, after her father's citizenship was also revoked.
It's definitely discriminatory and very heavy-handed and authoritarian, where people who express, their opinions or have, some sort of political dissent, the UAE is revoking their citizenship and therefore leaving them stateless. And also this is a policy of intimidation to sort of attack the relatives of such people in order to silence dissent. In the short term, this does not really prevent the problems, it only hides them, but in the long term, it's actually going to create dissent and create more anger and resentment for the regime because they're punishing people by revoking their citizenship. This is a very serious measure and is condemned around the world because you shouldn't revoke citizenship from people simply for exercising their political rights or for speaking out.
Recently, the Emirati authorities have promised to shelter 5,000 Afghan refugees in the wake of the recent developments in Afghanistan. A good PR exercise, per se. Many observers have taken the promise with a pinch of salt, given the grave reality back in the UAE.
It's very surprising that the UAE would offer to take in 5,000 Afghan refugees, because most of their policies and actions don't support that sort of humanitarian initiative. So I would be surprised if the UAE actually does follow through with it. It's a good move. It's good for public relations, but they have to follow through. And the UAE needs citizens and people to work in its country, because it relies so extensively on expatriates to do much of the work. And I think it's a very positive step, but it's out of character for them when you're revoking citizenship and punishing people and then taking in Afghan refugees. It's a surprise, quite frankly, and I hope they do follow through with it. But I suspect that they may come up with some sort of reasons to block it, because there's got many other people, like the Badoons, that should be given citizenship in the UAE and are not given citizenship.
Like many other things in the UAE, golden visas provide the country with a shiny veneer over dark matters Abu Dhabi likes to conceal. Things are not always as bright as they seem in this Persian Gulf state.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The United States and Australia went to extraordinary lengths to keep Paris in the dark as they secretly negotiated a plan to build nuclear submarines, scuttling France's largest defense contract and so enraging President Emmanuel Macron that on Friday, 17th of September, he ordered the withdrawal of France's ambassadors to both nations. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist David E. Sanger. The piece is titled Secret Talks and a Hidden Agenda Behind the U.S. Defense Deal That France Called a Betrayal. The United States and Australia went to extraordinary lengths to keep Paris in the dark as they secretly negotiated a plan to build nuclear submarines, scuttling France's largest defense contract and so enraging President Emmanuel Macron that on Friday, 17th of September, he ordered the withdrawal of France's ambassadors to both nations. President Emmanuel Macron's decision was a stunning and unexpected escalation of the breach between Washington and Paris, on a day that the two countries had planned to celebrate an alliance that goes back to the defeat of Britain in the Revolutionary War. Yet, it was driven by France's realization that two of its closest allies had been negotiating secretly for months. According to interviews with American and British officials, the Australians approached the new administration soon after President Biden's inauguration and said they had concluded that they had to get out of a $60 billion agreement with France to supply them with a dozen attack submarines. The conventionally powered French submarines, the Australians feared, would be obsolete by the time they were delivered. They expressed interest in seeking a fleet of quieter nuclear-powered submarines based on American and British designs that could patrol areas of the South China Sea with less risk of detection. But but it was unclear how they would terminate the agreement with France, which was already over budget and running behind schedule. They told us that they would take care of dealing with the French, one senior US official said. The Australians knew they had a receptive audience. President Biden, who had made pushing back hard on China's territorial ambitions a central tenet of his national security policy, told aides those French-made submarines would not do. They did not have the ability to range the Pacific and show up unexpectedly off Chinese shores, adding an element of military advantage for the West. The Australians, by all accounts, never made clear to the French that they were preparing to cancel the deal, which had taken years to negotiate. And in meeting after meeting with their French counterparts, some including President Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken, the Americans did not give French a heads up about their plans to step in with their own designs, the official said, asking for anonymity to discuss sensitive diplomacy. It was a classic case of diplomatic avoidance. President Biden's top aides finally discussed the issue with the French just hours before it was publicly announced at the White House in a virtual meeting with President Biden, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, and Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison. The result was a blow-up that has now led to a vivid breach of trust with one of America's oldest allies. In the end, President Biden's decision was the result of a brutal calculus that nations sometimes make, in which one ally is determined to be more strategically vital than another, something national leaders and diplomats never like to admit in public. And it was a sign that as President Biden begins to execute what the Obama administration 12 years ago called the pivot to Asia, there is the risk of stepping on political landmines as old traditional allies in Europe feel left behind. As much as the pivot has been described as pivoting to Asia without pivoting away from someplace else, that is just not possible, Richard Fontaine, the chief executive of the Center for a New American Security, who has long ties to both the Australian and American players in the deal, announced on Wednesday. Military resources are finite. Doing more in one area means doing less in others. It also apparently means hiding negotiations from some of your closest allies. By the time the Biden administration began engaging Australia and Britain seriously about its emerging strategy to counter China, a three-year-old contract worth $60 billion or more for a dozen submarines to be constructed largely by the French was already teetering, American officials said. The submarines were based on a propulsion technology that was so limited in range and so easy for the Chinese to detect that it would be obsolete by the time the first submarines were put in the water, perhaps as long as 15 years from now. There was an obvious alternative, the kind of nuclear-powered submarines deployed by the Americans and the British. But American and Australian officials agreed that if the French caught wind of the fact that the plug was going to be pulled on one of the biggest defense contracts in their history, they almost certainly would try to sabotage the alternative plan, according to officials who were familiar with the discussions between Washington and Canberra. So they decided to keep the work to a very small group of officials and made no mention of it to the French, even when President Biden and Antony Blinken met their French counterparts back in June. President Biden made no mention of the plans during the chummy chat with President Emmanuel Macron at a summit meeting in June in Cornwall in Britain, where they sat in lawn chairs by the sea and talked about the future of the Atlantic Alliance. Joe Biden, Boris Johnson, and Scott Morrison met together the same day, discussed the emerging deal, and, in a vague statement which seems more revealing today than it did then, referred to deepening strategic cooperation between the three governments to meet a changing defense environment in the Indo-Pacific. Just 3 days later, Scott Morrison met separately with Emmanuel Macron, but left no impression he was rethinking the deal, the French insist. According to French officials, Anthony Blinken also stayed silent on 25th of June, when his French counterpart Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian welcomed him back to Paris, where Anthony Blinken spent his high school years, and extolled the importance of the French submarine deal. And as recently as 30th of August, when the French and Australian Defence and Foreign Ministers held their annual consultation, they issued a joint communique that said the two countries were committed to deepening cooperation in the defence industry and underlined the importance of the future submarine programme. By that time, the Australians not only knew the programme was dead, they had nearly sealed the agreement in principle with Washington and London. The French ambassador to the United States, Philippe Etienne, said in several interviews that he first heard of the deal in leaked news reports appearing in the Australian media and in the website Politico. Other French officials said they had been suspicious that something was up a week ago, but did not get an immediate response from Anthony Blinken or the U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. The first American official to discuss the details with Ambassador Philippe Etienne was Jake Sullivan, the U.S. National Security Advisor, just a few hours before the public announcement on Wednesday. American officials insist it was not their place to talk to the French about their business deal with Australia. But now, in the light of the blow-up, some officials say they regret that they did not insist that the Australians level with the French about their intentions earlier. The Chinese government also did not get a heads up, no surprise since the official American position is that the submarine deal is not aimed at any particular nation. But China's first response to the new alliance, awkwardly named AUKUS, for Australia, the United Kingdom and the United States, was that it was extremely irresponsible and would start an arms race. In fact, the Pentagon's most recent China report says the Chinese Navy has built a dozen nuclear submarines, some of which can carry nuclear weapons. Australia has vowed never to deploy nuclear weapons. Even before Emmanuel Macron recalled the ambassadors from Washington and Canberra, Joe Biden's aides seemed taken back by the ferocity of the French response, especially Jean-Yves Le Drian's characterization that it was a knife in the back. They have suggested the French were being overly dramatic and believed the two countries will gradually return to normal relations. History suggests they may be right. A huge breach prompted by the British and French invasion of the Suez Canal in 1956 was eventually papered over, as was the Nixon shock with the Japanese in 1971, when the United States gave no notice about its decision to come off the gold standard. In this case, American officials said the decision to toss over the existing French-Australian contract and replace it with one that would bind Australia technologically and strategically to the nuclear submarine program generated virtually no internal debate. Reason was straightforward. In the Biden White House, the imperative to challenge China's growing footprint and its efforts to push the U.S. Navy east to the next island chain in the Pacific reigns supreme. It says a lot about how Washington discerns its interests in the Pacific, said Mr. Fontaine, that there was no hand-wringing about angering the French. Yet for years, American officials have known that the turn towards Asia could strain relations with European allies. While former President Barack Obama initially embraced the phrase "the pivot" to describe the American move to the region of the world where its economic and strategic interests are greatest, as a basketball player, he latched on to the sports metaphor. His White House eventually banned the public use of the phrase because of European objections. That did not stop Kurt Campbell, a major architect of the strategy, from publishing a 2016 book about it, The Pivot, The Future of American Statecraft in Asia, which was advertised as an account of a necessary course correction for American diplomacy, commercial engagement, and military innovations.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Farah Apel's Tanyanga in her fifth grade of primary school is one of hundreds of wounded children targeted by the Israeli regime. Shortly after the Israeli bombing of her house, Farah was transferred along with her mother and siblings to the hospital where their father.
Farah and her brothers and sisters were sleeping at home when the Israeli regime hit our house with no prior notice. They brought my kids to the very hospital where I work in. I was really shocked to see them. I've never expected to see my family in such a horrible condition. Farah was severely injured.
Farah, whose injury was highly critical, stayed for 7 days in a Shifa hospital, but her injury was severe and required traveling to Jordan for treatment. Unfortunately, all attempts failed to save Farah's legs, and she was eventually amputated.
Despite the fact that Farah has artificial legs, her morale is high. I thought that I would never see my child walking again, but now she's walking with her artificial legs.
Despite losing her legs, Farah is coming back from her treatment trip to take up her education in the school, where her teacher and classmates held a welcoming event for her.
I'm happy to be here and to see my friends once again. I'll do my best to continue my study. I know that I have to be strong and I will not give up my rights, whatever happens.
We held this ceremony to welcome Farah back from Jordan, where she spent a long treatment journey. Farah represents our Palestinian patience and resilience. She recovered from her injury and now is resuming her study. I have another 1,000 students here in this school, 20 of whom were injured during the latest Israeli escalation. Most of them have suffered from psychological stress.
Farah is now classified among a group of Palestinian children whose legs were amputated by the Israeli regime during the escalations over the Gaza Strip in serious violations of the right to life and childhood.
Children in Gaza are one of the victims of the Israeli crimes. The regime has deprived them the right to live in safety. Nearly 70 children in Gaza were killed and hundreds were injured during the 2021 conflict. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
By the European Commission's own admission, the EU failed miserably to react when COVID-19 took hold in the 27-country bloc. In March last year, it was left to Russia, yes, Russia, to fly in medical supplies to the worst-hit nation at the time, Italy. This as neighbouring EU countries closed their borders while Rome cried out for help.
We responded with ad hoc solutions.
But had we had HERA at that time, our preparedness and our crisis response would have been significantly different.
HERA is the Health Emergency Response Authority, a new €6 billion agency just unveiled by the European Commission. At the launch, EU Commissioner Margarita Schinas was attempting to big things up.
Europe is the most vaccinated country in the world.
Aside from calling the EU a country, people might be forgiven for thinking the EU had illegally annexed the 17 European countries that are not in the EU. HERA is going to cost €1 billion per year for 6 years, yet another big bill for taxpayers. Some EU lawmakers are wondering if it will work. After all, EU agencies never got to grips with the 2008 financial crisis or the 2015 refugee crisis. Activists claim the €6 billion would be better spent taking in desperate Afghan refugees. They say EU countries helped to create this latest refugee crisis, but are now closing their borders.
As long as we have people having to fly their home, go and be in either refugee camps or shelter where when it's available, we're not doing enough.
Regarding HERA, the point has also been made that the EU is inviting new health crises to the bloc by not sharing its huge stockpile of vaccines to poorer countries, mitigating the risk of new COVID-19 variants. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
North Korea fired two ballistic missiles from a railway Wednesday. Hours later, South Korea conducted its own submarine-launched ballistic missile test, raising tension in the East Asian region. The U.S. singled out only North Korea's provocative behavior.
These launches are in violation of multiple U.N. Security Council resolutions. And these activities highlight the destabilizing impact of the DPRK's illicit weapons program.
North Korea remains under United Nations Security Council sanctions over its nuclear and missile programs, which prevent the country from conducting international trade and inhibits North Koreans' access to food, medicine, and other goods available in most countries. Analysts argue North Korea is being treated unfairly.
South Korea has various missiles at a significant level of development. For North Korea, the more that South Korea, needless to say, the U.S. shows such a two-faced and double-standard position, the more North Korea will develop missiles and nuclear weapons, which is not favorable for anyone. One should try to understand the situation from North Korea's position.
The U.S. has 28,500 troops stationed in South Korea, with Seoul purchasing the latest American missiles, jet fighters, and other weapons in a regional arms race. The missile tests by North and South Korea over the past couple of weeks are unprecedented in recent times. And security experts warn that because of the close proximity of the probable targets and the potential destructive power of the bombs likely to be deployed, the time to respond to a perceived threat decreases, and the risk of miscalculation that could lead to a broader conflict grows. Still, there is hope the U.S. and North Korea may be encouraged to engage in dialogue. China this week lobbied for negotiations with its foreign minister Wang Yi visiting Japan and South Korea for talks. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Lebanon has received the first shipment of Iranian fuel since the beginning of a fuel crisis in the Mediterranean country. As tens of Syrian fuel tankers drove through Alain town in northern Bekaa, a solace of better days to come seemed to be stronger than the scent of diesel itself.
We declare that we have broken the U.S. siege, and now the resistance has begun the actual face-off against the U.S. directly with this initiative taken by the Secretary General of Hezbollah.
No matter what you do, we will be victorious. You can put sanctions on us and try to keep us in the cold, but we will defeat you. You cannot beat us or defeat our Sayyid.
Men, women, and children chanted as they welcomed the tankers. They say if it weren't for Iran and Syria, what would have happened to them?
I cannot express my happiness now. I want to thank Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and the Islamic Republic of Iran. They give us victory.
These little girls insisted on expressing their feelings towards Hezbollah for initiating the import of fuel in their own way.
We love Sayyid Hassan because he is the father of all Lebanese,
and he give us pride and dignity.
Experts believe the arrival of Iranian fuel through Syria means more than mere fuel supply for months to come.
This is a courageous and historic step that very strongly broke the sanctions imposed by the U.S. and its allies in Lebanon. This step came to say no to the attempt